dog is gonna have the news.
We got a special episode. It's LA Podcast. Hello, Scott Frazier.
Hey, Ace.
And folks, it is special. This is a special one. This one is good. They're all fine. This one is good.
Yeah, it's a keeper.
Scott and I read a story in the LA Times last week about the LA County Sheriff's Department and some accusations of deputies at the Compton station forming gangs within the department where they all get matching tattoos. And according to these accusations, celebrate aggressive police tactics, maybe outside of their code of conduct as officers.
Yep. This is something that I think there were, over the past week or so, a string of articles basically talking about these allegations of a deputy clique, a so-called clique within the department. And
in Compton specifically.
In Compton specifically, linking the concerns about that behavior among deputies to a very long tradition, a decades-long tradition within the sheriff's department of deputies engaging in these kind of secret, for lack of a better word, essentially gangs.
Yeah, this has been going on for a long time. I confess to not having had any idea how often this had happened over the years, since the 70s. So we decided to do an episode about it. So for some quick myth busting about the sheriff's department, people think of law enforcement in Los Angeles, they think LAPD, of course.
Yep, but actually the sheriff's department is larger.
Way bigger.
Yep, it's the largest sheriff's department in the country.
They employ 18,000 people, LAPD has about 12,000.
So 18,000 employees, 10,000
uniformed. 10,000 uniformed. Which is about the same as LAPD, actually, but it's a little more than LAPD, but they have way more civilian staff. People also think the sheriff's department is just in charge of the jails, which they are, but they also patrol the city, and they're in total charge of policing for cities within LA County that don't have their own police departments, such as West Hollywood, Santa Clarita, and Compton.
Yep. So this is kind of an interesting thing about, so the sheriff's department patrols unincorporated parts of the county. One of the interesting things about Los Angeles County is that we have a lot of smaller municipal governments that actually, for the most part, are only able to exist as separate entities, as incorporated cities, mm-hmm. because they contract with the county to provide various services to them. And the law enforcement aspect of that is a very large consideration.
Some cities, West Hollywood and Santa Clarita, never had their own police departments. They've always contracted with the sheriff's department. Compton did, but in 2002, the Compton Police Department was abolished in scandal. But another thing people may not realize is how absolutely racked with scandal the LA Sheriff's Department has been for the last few years. I think the best representation of that is that the last sheriff, Lee Baca, was sentenced to 3 years in prison, and his undersheriff, Paul Tanaka, is currently serving a five-year sentence.
Who was briefly running and leading the race to replace Lee Baca before he was actually arrested.
Yeah, 2014, when Jim McDonald, the current sheriff, took over, was voted in. So we wanted to talk about these gangs in the sheriff's department. We brought in two people who are intimately familiar with what's going on there to talk about gangs at the Compton station and the culture of gangs in general. The first is Maya Lau, the LA Times reporter who broke the story. Maya Lau, reporter for the LA Times, thank you for joining us.
Sure, thanks for having me.
You've been at the Times, you've been covering the Sheriff's Department for about a year and a half. Before mm-hmm. that, you were in Baton Rouge. Mm-hmm. You covered the notorious Angola prison, the largest maximum security prison in the country. You uncovered stories of financial impropriety that led to the resignation of the warden, Burl Cain. You also broke a lot of corruption in the state prison system. Since you came to the other LA only a year and a half ago to cover LASD, you have not slowed down. You've broken a lot of big, kind of disconcerting stories most notably a list of sheriff's deputies who had committed misconduct that the sheriff's union had tried to keep secret. That all checks out. That sounds like something,
yes,
something
you
did.
Thank you. It's very kind of you.
Now you have a new story that began with a shooting in 2016. I think it makes sense to start there.
Sure.
With that shooting. Can you tell us about it?
So there was a shooting of a guy that deputies claimed that they saw a weapon on him. They saw him kind of pull out a weapon and that he ran away. They chased him. It was nighttime. They ended up shooting and killing him. His name was Dante Taylor. And deputies said that they believed that he was actually pointing a gun at them, or at least one of them, right before the man was shot dead. But no weapon was found on the man.
Anywhere else.
Or in the area. Yeah. Authorities said that they found some sort of gun residue on the man's shorts, and they thought that that was consistent potentially with a gun at some point having been in the man's shorts, but no weapon was actually found at the scene.
Okay, so Dante Taylor's family got a lawyer, John Sweeney, who's handled a lot of cases like this in the past, and the lawyer sought out other people who had encounters with these same deputies. Samuel Aldama and Mizrain.
Those are the deputies.
Orego,
right.
Are the deputies.
Those are the deputies, not the other plaintiffs.
Not the other plaintiffs. Yes, yes, yes.
Right.
But they did find another a plaintiff, a guy named Sheldon Lockett,
right,
who had been beaten by these same deputies 6 months later. Is that correct?
Right.
Or six months earlier.
Actually, yeah, that's right. 6 months before the Dante Taylor shooting. So Sheldon Lockett said that he was outside. I think this was daylight. He was standing around at his godmother's house. I think deputies believed that he was the suspect in a completely unrelated case. And they, you know, approached him and somehow that encounter ended up with, you know, he said that he was beaten and that he's black, and that racial epithets, the N-word, was repeatedly said. These are his allegations. And, you know, what happened is that the case that was filed against him, he was arrested, I think, on suspicion of a completely unrelated crime, and he was, the charges were dropped against him. So he was not prosecuted ultimately. But his mother made a complaint with the sheriff's department saying, basically laying out, you know, what I just said, that, you know, my son was beaten by these two deputies.
And he wasn't prosecuted, but he did stay.
He was in jail for a while. Yeah. On suspicion of I think it was an attempted murder case.
And the deputies actually returned to her house, his mother's house, while he was in custody. Right. Is that?
Yeah.
So I don't know that is her allegation. I haven't separately looked deeply into that, but I believe she alleged that at some point, you know, deputies came to her house and broke in and looking for something. Yeah.
Kicked their front door off. What she says anyway is that they were looking for Sheldon Lockett, who was in prison at the time, but they had a warrant. Something got crossed up. They had a warrant for him. And so they kicked her door in. But he wasn't there obviously because he was in jail.
Those are the allegations that I've heard. Yeah.
Okay. So John Sweeney, the lawyer, got these cases together, and he deposes Samuel Aldama, the deputy who's involved in both cases. And he asked Aldama about a tattoo that he had, that I guess John Sweeney, the lawyer, somehow already knew that he had this tattoo, right?
Maybe so, who knows, yeah.
Well, he said in the deposition, John Sweeney said that he asked him about if he had any tattoos, right, and Samuel Aldama said no. And then he said, what about the one on your leg?
Right.
And then the deputy.
Right. And so then the deputy described this tattoo that he has on his calf of a skull, kind of skeleton with a big skull face, big eyes, a military style helmet, holding a rifle with flames all around it. And with CPT, the acronym for Compton Station. And the deputy admits to having this tattoo. They take a picture of it, an official picture that, you know, emerges in the lawsuit as this is actually, you know, his leg. And, you know, the deputy says that it's just a tattoo and he was allowed to get it.
And this tattoo that Aldama has, he said 10 to 20 other officers and the other deputies in the Compton station have the same tattoo.
Have a tattoo like it. Yeah.
Right. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But of course, the department has a history of these so-called cliques, which are controversial. You know, some deputies think, look, this is a brotherhood. You know, we do a tough job and we get into situations where, you know, maybe if you were in a life or death scenario, you would get a tattoo too, or they just view it as this is a morale boosting thing. But of course, the history is that also some of these groups have been found to have kind of glorified violence or, you know, awarded tattoos after you get in a shooting and have, you know, a judge about 30 years ago after an investigation called the Vikings a neo-Nazi gang. So essentially
the Vikings
a gang
was another
one of these.
Yeah.
Deputy.
And so, I mean, just to back up a little bit, because mm-hmm. I think a lot of listeners are probably not familiar with this concept that you're bringing up of this deputy clique. You mentioned Deputy Aldama has this tattoo that a number of other sheriff's deputies apparently have. So basically, what is the reason why the defendant's lawyer would actually want to focus on this? And as far as you understand it, like, what is the concern for the ability of somebody like Deputy Aldama to be policing in a neutral way when he's out on the streets because he may or may not belong to a group within the sheriff's department like this?
Right. So I think that the concern is that because in the past, these groups, there have been strong allegations, and in some cases, there have been findings that these groups actually were glorifying highly aggressive policing or police tactics that would not be something to glorify. Like, there's, you know, things that happen in policing, but you don't necessarily, you know, throw a party about it.
Sometimes officer involved shootings.
Right. Things happen. And the concern is that, you know, you're basically bonding and glorifying over this thing. That's what the concern is. And so I think that the, you know, the concern here is that this is a repeat of that, and that you have a group that maybe is going out and looking for scenarios or targeting people. And certainly the claim by this lawyer is that it's that there's racial bias, that that deputies have some sort of racial animus against against Black people.
Now, he asked the deputy about that specifically in his deposition. He asked if he had any racial animus against African Americans. And how did the deputy respond? A lot has been made over this part of the deposition. What happened?
Right. So the lawyer asked this deputy, do you have any racial animus against African Americans? I think he was asked to clarify the question. He said, do you have any ill feelings against African Americans in general? The deputy took a long time to respond and eventually said, I do, sir. And then when asked to elaborate, said that he didn't understand the question, and later said, I don't have any ill feelings against African Americans.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, people can look at that many different ways. Did he hear something wrong and just not understand the question? Or did he say, oh, just kidding, I didn't understand, you know?
Yeah.
Who knows?
I'll say, watching it, the weirdest mm-hmm. thing is the pause.
Right,
pauses after these questions where he's just kind of staring.
Yeah, and I think that also from my perspective watching it, the number of opportunities that that the lawyer gives him essentially to give a different answer, or he rephrases, he uses a different word than animus. He asks him if he understands what the intended line of questioning is, basically, and repeats it several times. And the ultimate thing you see in the video, in the deposition rather, is that he says, he sort of affirms, yes, I do have ill feelings. And then he starts talking about his experience working at the Compton station.
And that he grew up in Compton among right. all different kinds of people, which could be an answer to now, saying that you don't have any bias, but it's very confusing.
Right. Now, later, when you say that later he said that he didn't, he misunderstood the question, that was later, as in after the deposition took place, right?
No. So, and we posted, I think, the full video that you can see what I'm talking about all the way through,
okay.
where he took a long pause. He said, yes, I do. And he started talking about growing up in Compton. And then really just like a few beats later, he said, I misunderstood.
I thought the lawyer said that they went on a break. And then after that was wrong.
Yeah, it's okay. a little confusing. Okay. I think that he said, I misunderstood.
Okay.
And then later they took a break.
Uh-huh.
And later he came back and said, I also just want to say again,
okay.
I misunderstood that question.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
So there were a couple times he said that he misunderstood.
I want to talk about the Linwood Vikings a little bit. Mm-hmm. This is one of the earliest, wasn't that long ago, it was only in the 80s. But a gang in the sheriff's department of the Linwood station, the members, they were called a neo-Nazi group, like you said, mm-hmm. by a judge.
Mm-hmm.
The members included the last sheriff, Lee Baca.
I'm not sure that it included Baca, but Tanaka, the undersheriff.
Paul Tanaka.
Right.
So Paul Tanaka was a member who's currently in prison.
Right.
For hiding an FBI informant, which we'll get to more about that later. Lee Baca, sentenced to prison, is not in prison.
He has been convicted.
Appeal. He's been
and
convicted.
And he's not in prison as of now.
Yes.
Yeah, he's on appeal, right.
A lot of these other gangs, the Jump Out Boys in 2012, the 2,000, 3,000 boys at the jails, a lot of them formed under the oversight of Lee Baca during his 16-year tenure. Do you get a sense of the culture having changed at all under Jim McDonald, the guy who took his place, who's currently the sheriff?
You know, I think it's hard to say. I mean, a lot of people say the culture has changed in general for the better, that there have been reforms. A lot of deputies would tell you that the culture is worse. They feel that there's worse morale. They feel that there's punitive types of discipline, that it's not meaningful discipline. And I think the thing to know is just these so-called cliques or groups or whatever you want to call them have actually been around a really long time, at least as far back as the 1970s and possibly before then. It's also something that likely happens in other law enforcement agencies. So this is kind of an ongoing thing. And I think it's really interesting to talk about, because when you talk to different people, there's a real spectrum of opinions, even within the department, of some people saying, look, I'm an officer, I don't have a tattoo. The reason why is that I know that if I get one, it kind of makes me beholden to these other officers. And I feel that there's something wrong about that. You know, if you're going to get a tattoo, get it of the badge or get it of a sheriff's star. Some people say that. Others say, look, you know, I mean, free speech and, you know, I can do whatever I want. And these are my people. I work day in, day out with them. I have their back. They have my back. And if we want to get a skull tattoo, you know, like,
yeah. I think we should note, definitely, as you mentioned, that the gangs date as far back as
right.
the 70s, at least in terms of what has been documented and
right.
the number of times this has been brought up in court cases and in the press. Lee Baca, the previous sheriff, was adamantly opposed to the existence of them within mm-hmm. the department. He made it kind of a goal of his to stamp them out. And had said basically, I was always aware of these when I was working in the department and I never liked it. And now I'm the sheriff. I don't want people doing this, but had a very difficult time, actually mm-hmm. eradicating
right.
their presence within the department.
He also, I just want to point out, I saw a KTLA interview with him where he talks about the officers who had complained about the gangs within the sheriff's department and said that they should man up and not be wimps.
Okay.
He said, have you ever heard of a cop who's like bullied? I mean, like I would like, there was a lot of rhetoric, like you're saying, about he's trying to get rid of the gangs, but it's unclear how he actually
went about it. And I think that goes to something else that you were saying, Maya, about essentially the change in culture as it is now attempting to be carried out by Sheriff McDonald, which I think that we've seen in recent years that there is a real sensitivity among police officers about essentially whether or not they're being punished for things that they view as being sort of inherent in their job, and this like notion that they share experiences among themselves that, for lack of a better word, outsiders don't, or civilians don't necessarily understand about about doing the job. So I think that sort of speaks to the mentality of the clique that we're seeing in terms of people wanting to sort of affirm that they're sharing some kind of experience in the department.
Right. And yeah, you do hear that a lot of, you know, you couldn't, unless you've done this job, you couldn't possibly understand what it is to do this job. And so, you know, you can question it, you can look at it, but ultimately you'll never understand it unless you do it. I think that what the community has said is, you know, even though we're not cops, the community has said, but you also have to understand our point of view, you know, because you serve the public. So even though the public doesn't, they're not all officers, you know, we pay your salaries and, you know, you have to understand our point of view too, that we might look at this and see it a different way. And so, yeah, there is that kind of tension of, you know, is it just that, people are not seeing eye to eye, or is there a real problem here? And I also think it's a big question whether or not the sheriff's department even can regulate this, because how do you tell someone, you know, we have, you know, the First Amendment, you know, you can't tell someone to not,
but they're not allowed to have exposed tattoos at the sheriff's department.
Right.
So that
and they
already
don't, right.
is
they like, don't expose them in their uniform.
Yes.
But how do you tell someone, oh, in your private, you know, life and in your parts of your body that aren't seen by the public, you're not allowed to do what you will with your body.
Right.
But
well, that is what they're telling people in the areas that they police.
Yeah.
Right? I mean, they're allowed to cite gang members or like people with gang affiliated tattoos. They're allowed to roll up on them for having certain markings. And in fact, Dante Taylor, the person who was killed, was approached initially by the deputies for the hat he was wearing. He was wearing a red hat that they thought meant that he had a gang affiliation.
Right.
So, I mean, it does seem like, I mean, if you're going to open it up to how do you police people for the just the markings that they wear on their body, this is like one of the hallmarks of how policing happens in LA in the other direction, right?
Right. And one of the civilian oversight commissioners in another story I did last week, you know, she said that. She said, you know, frequently we hear that a deceased person who was shot and killed by police was a gang member or was a suspected gang member as a sort of way of the police somehow contextualizing their death and in some ways justifying their death. And, you know, here it's problematic because you have allegations of a gang within the department. And so how is that really different? And so I think these things are coming up again. And I think it's been interesting that the Sheriff McDonald has not been quite as vocal in the same way that Sheriff Baca was against these tattoos specifically. You know, he's like, we're looking into it. And I was unhappy to hear about this, but not, if you kind of go back and read some of the quotes from Baca, it's a lot more like, I'm against this, you know, and this is bad. And I think he was even one of the people to say, if you want to get a tattoo, get it of a badge, you know, stuff like that.
Sheriff McDonald, you had another article recently, is in the middle of a surprisingly tough election Do you think that has any impact on how much he wants to be talking about gangs within the sheriff's department right
now? Yeah, I don't know. I mean, you know, it's a surprising situation for him to be in a runoff, and especially the person he's in a runoff with is not somebody that people thought would be the second place person. There was another candidate, retired commander Bob Lindsay, who seemed to have a lot more support, or a lot more vocal, kind of active support, I would say. And so, yeah, I mean, this is kind of, you know, this situation hasn't happened a lot in the county over the last century. It's happened just a few times. I had actually had to like read these super old clips from 1914 and stuff to count. Wow. I think there was, it's happened like six times in the past century, but, you know, it's not common. So yeah, no, he's probably, you know, having to think about a lot of things that he did not think that he would have to deal mm-hmm. with at this point.
So here's what we still don't know about the Compton Station clique. We don't know the names of anyone else who's in it, right? We don't know if Samuel O'Donnell's partner is in it. The lawyer John Sweeney alluded to a reason why the partner wasn't deposed. Do we know anything about that? Is he still on the force?
No, the partner Orego mm-hmm. was fired, but the captain of the Compton Station told me that it was for something completely unrelated, but then wouldn't tell me what it was for. Hmm. But was fired after this shooting.
Okay. What's next, I guess, in this?
You know, we'll be looking for what the department is going to do, if there's going to be a separate investigation specifically looking into this, what will come of that, if this is going to be part of an ongoing investigation, administrative investigation into that shooting, if, you know, just what else comes of it, if it comes out from the lawsuit. You know, more that, you know, there could be something else from the lawsuit about who else has the tattoo, what it means, and how recent. I think that the big thing is how recently did people get the tattoos? You know, it's not like, oh, I have this tattoo, it's from 10 years ago. It's, I think part of what was interesting was that Deputy Aldama got it 2 years ago,
mm-hmm.
which is in this era of reform and, you know, new day. And, you know, I should also say that the CCJV, the Citizens Commission on Jail Violence, I always get the acronym a little bit wrong. I think that's right. McDonald, the current sheriff, was on that commission, and that commission specifically called out these tattoos and said that they're destructive, and you know, we should do what we can to discourage deputies and have them cover up their tattoos. So yeah, it's kind of be interesting to see, you know, what the department does about this and if they can do anything, and if they should. I don't know. I mean, what do you guys think?
Well, so what I think honestly is to me these sound a lot like they make me think of two things. One is the sort of legacy that we have in the city of Angelenos of different backgrounds, describing law enforcement as acting like an occupying army, and military forces throughout modern history, to my knowledge, have sort of done this same sort of routine thing. You know, you think of like, I don't know, Band of Brothers or something like that. Mm-hmm. You have like smaller subsets within a larger force who are closely linked and want to memorialize that in some way.
And the tattoo definitely reflects that. There's nothing about
it's very martial
about like local policing on it. It's a military. It's all like military symbols.
It's very martial. The difference between the military and the law enforcement being that the law enforcement officials are in the admittedly difficult position of you know, protect and serve. They are policing the population that they also are charged with protecting. So so to me, it is troubling that you might have a small group or several small groups within a law enforcement organization that are
taking upon themselves potentially a separate mission than the one that they are charged by the community with.
No, one last question, Maya, for you. Thank you again for talking to us about this. Do you feel like this, to my knowledge, and correct me if I'm wrong, came to light because of the line of questioning raised by the defendant's lawyer? Is that right? Or
so it's actually the plaintiff's lawyer, because now it's a civil case. Yeah. Right. I think it is that lawyer that kind of brought this up and was trying to find out if the deputy is part of a group with a tattoo.
I mean, do you feel like there's a public concern there where potentially the public just doesn't know about in cases of other officer-involved shootings or officer-involved violent arrests, that the public won't necessarily know that the deputy involved belong to a group like this? And is that a concern?
Yeah, I mean, I think that there's a concern that why are we learning about this from a lawsuit? Why are we learning about this from an outside force or from a outside investigation or whatever you want to call it? It's not as though, I mean, it'd be a bit hard to imagine that the sheriff's department does a press conference and says, by the way, we want to let you know about this group of tattoos. But, you know, there is always that concern of why are we learning this after the fact? And what else do we not know? And, you know, why is the department only saying that they're looking into this after the questions have been asked?
That was cool. She was great.
Yeah, Maya was excellent. There's a huge amount of information in there, and really appreciate her taking the time
to talk
to us.
She's breaking stories like that all the time, too. And she's at Maya Lau on Twitter.
For updates on
you
that
You should
story.
Follow her there. Moving on to our next discussion, we wanted to talk to someone who had experienced the culture of the Sheriff's Department firsthand. So we brought on a guy named James Sexton, who was a former deputy with the Sheriff's Department. James's story is a very interesting one. He was working in the Sheriff's Department. His job was to develop inmates into informants so sheriffs would know exactly what was going on in the jails. And so he got a lot of tips from inmates on murders, drug smuggling, that kind of thing. Eventually, one of his informants told him that a deputy named Joe Britton in Men's Central Jail was working with an inmate, the head of, I believe, the Aryan Brotherhood, or a white supremacist gang. And Joe Britton, the deputy, is smuggling this inmate dope and cell phones. And so James Sexton and another deputy, Michael Rathbun, wrote up a report. They gave it to their superior, Lieutenant Greg Thompson, and Thompson gave the report straight to Joe Britton, unredacted. So now Joe Britton and other deputies know that Sexton filed this report. They also know the identity of the informant. But Sexton starts getting called a rat. He says he was attacked by a deputy who waited for him at his car. He got death threats. So then the FBI comes to him, and they're investigating violence at the jail. They've heard what's happening to James, and they ask James Sexton if he wants to inform for the FBI as part of their investigation. And James Sexton is understandably frustrated with the department at this point. He says yes, he will inform. And he tells the FBI something about an inmate named Anthony Brown. Anthony Brown was also an FBI informant, this inmate, but the sheriffs found out he was informing. They found an FBI cell phone among his stuff. So the sheriffs developed a plan to move Anthony Brown around to different prisons and change his name in the record book so the FBI would not be able to find him contact him. And James Sexton got the order to move Anthony Brown. He did it. He called it Operation Pandora's Box. And so now Sexton is working with the FBI, and he tells them about hiding Anthony Brown. He agrees to testify in front of a grand jury that he did this and about the other deputies involved. Not realizing at the time that by testifying, he was admitting to obstruction of justice himself. So even though he cooperated, he ended up getting sentenced to 18 months in prison. There's actually a good Vice News did an animated version of James's story that if you just Google James Sexton Vice, you can watch, and it kind of lays everything out if it's confusing. 21 people in the sheriff's department were convicted out of this scandal. The sheriff, Lee Baca, was one of them, sentenced to 3 years in prison, which he's appealing because he has Alzheimer's, so he is not locked up at this time. Paul Tanaka, the undersheriff, who we talked about earlier as a member of one of these gangs, the Vikings, is locked up, sentenced to 5 years in jail. Greg Thompson, James' superior, got 37 months. Joe Britton, the deputy who James Sexton informed on initially, who was working with the white supremacist gang member, was never charged with anything and is in fact now working at the Compton station where Samuel Aldama is also employed, that's currently having this problem with gangs. James got 18 months, which he fought for a while, but eventually he asked to serve his time. So he could move on with his life. He talks about in this interview the adult decision, in quotes, that that he and his wife made, which was basically when he agreed to start serving his sentence because he was in his 20s at the time,
yeah,
and just wanted to be done with this. He has served his time. He's released. He's still living and working in L.A. He's working on prison reform now.
And he agreed to talk to us as somebody with the perspective of having seen the sheriff's department from both sides of the law, I suppose you would say.
Yes. So let's talk to James Sexton. James Sexton, thank you for talking with us. You grew up in a law enforcement family. Your dad was a sheriff in Alabama, which is where my dad is from as well. How old were you when you joined the LA Sheriff's Department?
It's been almost 11 years now. I think I was, I turned 22.
So right out of, did you go straight from Alabama to here, basically?
I did. I went to the University of Alabama, and mm-hmm. then I ran away from home.
Uh-huh.
I ran away from home. As you stated, my father was a six-term elected sheriff, and he cast a long shadow, and I wanted to follow in his footsteps, but I wanted to do it bigger and better than he did. And so that brought me to the largest sheriff's department in the country, the LA County Sheriff's Department.
Now, we've talked a little in our intro about your story, how you ended up testifying against other deputies, how you ended up spending some time in jail. When did you get fully released?
I finished everything this year, January 2018. You know, as you guys are aware, it's just tough to talk about.
Of course.
I lost my appeal in July of 2016, and then my wife and I made a very hard decision. The one thing that that you can't get back is time. And immediately right there, I did the math, and I was the first one in, I'm the first one out, and I'm done. But
you must feel like because you testified, ended up saving you sometime, right?
There's a couple of things. I took this trial, I had a mistrial, and there's 17 jurors that don't think that a crime was committed here. But people ask me, why did you go to trial? I wasn't going to plead guilty to a civil rights violation. I accept responsibility for my actions and Pandora's box, but I still don't think there was a crime. I put my life on the line for this Constitution, and I exercised my right to trial, and I think that was validated by my mistrials. But you have to accept the outcomes. That's a tough lesson. You know, I'm a millennial too. It's a tough mm-hmm. lesson people have to learn these days. There's reality to the situation here, and that resulted in me going to prison. And my wife and I made that decision collectively in 2016, and I was scheduled to do, the feds, you do 85%, and then they back up either 6 to 9 months for your halfway house time. So, I was getting out regardless in 2017, and that was based on the very adult decision my wife and I made in July of 2016. So I did 10 correctional facilities. That was in part because Sheriff Baca refused to accept whatever agreements were made, and that was separate of me. I wasn't aware of those. I was serving my time, And as a result of that agreement falling apart and him going to trial, I was transferred. I did Con Air. I mean, it was, you know, Club Fed's a misnomer. I didn't do that. I did high-powered facilities. I did a lot of shoe time. And, you know, it had had a dramatic impact on my life and my mindset.
Well, we want to talk about the larger culture of the Sheriff's Department. I have one more question about you personally before we get into that. You have stayed here. You've come back to L.A., and you and your wife appear to have kind of set up shop here.
Yep.
This could be a place that, you know, had like tough associations for you, but you want to stay.
You know, there's some macros into that decision. The first one is the first institution that reached out and picked me up, and that's the University of Southern California. I got my graduate degree during this time period in my life, and the University of Southern California, I'm forever grateful for what they did.
Who was it there specifically? Who were some people that reached out?
Yeah, they're the dean of Price, my professor, Dr. Vertentin. You know, they helped me piece my life back together. There's some folks, Celeste Freeman, you know, that are alumni, and you know, I'm not the first felon in the world to rebuild, but you know, I'm involved in science and technology now that's dealing with prison reform, recidivism reduction. We're doing a lot of things for suicide, things that I know that's separate of what we're trying to talk about, but things that I have a firsthand experience with. I've been in 43 correctional facilities in my adult life and counting, and you know, I saw all these things in prison. I want to continue to make a difference. You know, I want to help deputies that are, or law enforcement that are facing this. There's four things that if you're going to be in law enforcement in 2018 moving forward, you better be ready to accept. You better be ready to lose four things. First one's your life. The second one's your liberty. The third one's your health. And the fourth one's a relationship. I've lost three out of the four. And if you only lose one, you're lucky.
But you and your wife are...
My wife and I are fine.
Oh, but, okay. I thought you were...
But,
yes.
No, but it, sure. That relationship was strained, but...
Of course.
My father comes to mind.
Yeah.
He and I are kind of in a protracted battle. I wanted to be that man when I grew up. And Lee Baca and the LA County Sheriff's Department put him and I to hard decisions.
Because he was friends with Lee Baca, right?
He absolutely was friends with Lee Baca. Yeah. You know, some can make the argument that I was collateral damage in this investigation because of his rank and title. Lee Baca preyed upon that relationship. He knew, we're here to talk about Deputy Clicks in the LA County Sheriff's Department.
Yeah.
You know, things that are going on in the department are in vogue again, and things that I was never in a Deputy Click, but I definitely was recruited to be in one. I'm familiar with the individuals that are in them.
Yeah.
I know the process well. I know the supervisors that are still involved, and
yeah. I mean, so let's actually
let's get into
some of that, because you started by saying that some things are back in vogue again. Yeah. So let's talk about your time in inmate reception, and from your standpoint, was this kind of like that there were fewer people that were part of these cliques back then? Was it really a deeply ingrained part of the department from your standpoint? Or what was it like when you joined up, essentially?
I want to be very clear that there, when you come into the LA County Sheriff's Department, you're made aware of deputy cliques. You're made aware of secret societies or gangs, for lack of a better word, in the department, but they aren't prevalent. They really aren't. There are a lot of good men and women that serve honorably throughout the LA County Sheriff's Department in their entire career that see these things once or twice, and they say no, and they never come up again. That being said, you know, I was exposed to Mr. Tanaka and Lieutenant Greg Thompson and those folks, and the politics of the department are deeply intertwined with Deputy Clicks and, yeah. and Deputy Gangs.
We talked a little bit about Paul Tanaka, who was undersheriff under Lee Baca. He was a member of the Linwood Vikings. When you yes. say you were exposed to him, was that in the context of joining a clique?
Yes, I was recruited but was not involved. I said no several times. To his question, when you come into custody facilities, you're being assessed, in Men's Central Jail, and I'm not here to call out, individuals, but there are gangs that started in Men's Central Jail that are feeder groups to other gangs and stations and throughout the department.
What were the names of some of those gangs?
I mean, you can Google them, but
sure.
You know,
the 2,000 boys, the 3,000
yes.
boys. Yes.
Yes. I mean, I'll confirm those, but
sure.
As far as me,
yeah,
laying sure. those guys out, I still have respect for a lot of folks.
Right, but those have been made very public. That refers to the 2,000 block yes. and 3,000 block of
yes.
Men's Central.
Right, and the Quiet Canyon fight, mm-hmm. which is kind of one of the events that started everything with what I was involved in. Was deputy gangs fighting.
Mm-hmm. You said something I want to go back to. You said that there are lots of deputies who are good people who never get involved in these cliques. What a lot of the members of the cliques say is that it's just an acknowledgement of hard work. It doesn't sound like you are really buying that line, that it's associated with over-aggressive tactics.
No, I'm on the record with this.
Yeah.
With the HBO interview I did, but...
mm-hmm.
When you're referring to yourself in the manner that they do with just the name alone, that's a social club at best, and it's a gang at worst. And, they understand what the requirements are to get there. Generally, it's noteworthy uses of force, things that we refer to as 10:30, those types of things where you're outside of policy. I mean, that's
10:30 is like
it's a radio code for, mm-hmm. It's out of policy, does not conform. Mm-hmm. So,
I want to specifically to what you're saying. One of these sheriff gangs, the Jump Out Boys, which were part of a gang enforcement division,
yeah.
right? No single station or jail. They had a pamphlet where they said about themselves, "We are alpha dogs who think and act like the wolf, but never become the wolf." It sounds like that's sort of what you're talking about, that they use criminal gang tactics to operate. I'm just curious, there's all these stylistic similarities with the tattoos and this kind of thing between the gangs that are being policed and the gangs within the sheriff's department. What do you think that is about?
As law enforcement officer and how my career trajectory is and just in my life, you have a front row seat to tragedy. You have a front row seat to darkness. And, it's natural to emulate those things, or be impacted by them. And, we get paid to be the more sophisticated and higher authority on it, but like you saw in that deposition that you posted on your Twitter account, that's an unfortunate outcome of bad background, bad training. That's not the LA County Sheriff's Department. I'll be the first one to say that. And I think that's counterintuitive. People be like, why is he defending the LA County Sheriff's Department? I love the LA County Sheriff's Department. I still think I should be there.
Yeah.
And I think people would argue that, but I got dealt a bad hand and I got a bad beat and here we are. But that gentleman is not the LA County Sheriff's Department. That gentleman's not Compton Station. That's the station that I was scheduled to go to. I have near and dear friends there. I, for the most part, adore that chain of command. Captain Thatcher is a wonderful human being. Holly Perez is the commander. She's a wonderful person. I worked with her at IRC. That's not a representation of them at all.
You've had pretty strong words for the individuals that actually are organizing themselves in this way, behaving in certain ways while they're on the job, while they're on the beat. I wonder, do you feel like it is incumbent upon the supervisors, members of the chain of command, to do something more to stop the CLIC organizations? And if so, do you think it's possible for them to do that?
I do, and that's, look, that's a complicated question. I'll try to unwind it for you. Sheriff McDonald inherited this problem. I think he deserves another term. I think he is doing the best he can. And I'll just work my way down top to bottom as well. He understands it from his perspective as sheriff and from the Commission on Jail Violence and from a chief's perspective, from a organization that is not the LA County Sheriff's Department. LA County Sheriff's Department is the largest sheriff's department in the country. And with that, the deputies have swagger. And so there's an autonomy that has been propagated down to the deputy level from Block and those guys all the way back, because a sheriff is an elected office. It's the chief law enforcement officer in the county. And, you know, I'm not trying to give you a lecture on, but
please,
we are deputy sheriffs. We, you know, and I said this in my trial, it's not the undersheriff's department, it's the sheriff's department. And, I can't, again, people would say, why are you praising Jim McDonald? But I think he is doing a good job. He is being disserved. And this is where I will be a little more strident and a little more pointed. He is being disserved by gentlemen that quite honestly founded some of these organizations and are still amongst his chief level. You know, why am I in this room today? Why, you know, we've said it's in vogue. Look, I'm a whistleblower and I called out, Joe Britton, who is at Compton Station. And we're talking about Compton Station. That's why
he's at Compton Station
he's
now.
At Compton Station
okay,
now.
I didn't realize that. But this was a deputy who was who you blew the whistle on for providing, for smuggling. Well, you can be more specific.
Yeah, this isn't, again, it's not about me and his case, but
sure.
You know, it's just one of the reasons that I even came in contact with the FBI for my case is that I blew the whistle. There is no 911 for the FBI. Okay? You can't, I don't care who you are in America, you cannot get in contact with your local FBI agent and then get some sort of, you know, contact like you would if you dialed 911 for your local police department.
You blew the whistle not to the FBI, within the department.
I blew it within my own department at my own risk.
Other deputies started to come down on you, and then the FBI got in touch, correct?
Yes, but to his point, this is why this case is so complicated.
Yeah.
I took it to Lieutenant Greg Thompson, who is a member of the Linwood Vikings, okay?
Mm-hmm.
Which came up in the trial. And at my own risk, again, my point here is that whistleblowers aren't celebrated. Okay, they're not. I wish that I could sit in front of the sheriff and say, "You have this problem because the guy that looks like me." And I all things matter when we start talking about this. I'm a male white from Alabama. I do not look like the poster child of civil rights or police reform. I know that. I do. You know, people make snap judgments, and you have to live with that. But On the day in February of 2012 when I elected to blow the whistle, I actually had two informants come to me and report misconduct by folks in Men's Central Jail. The first informant reported on Remington Orr, who is was a male black custody assistant, and it was handled correctly. He was subsequently arrested a week later with an ounce of cocaine in his pocket. This happened the same day. Joe Britton, from a credible informant that Michael Rathbun and I developed, we reported that to Gregory Thompson, and he forever changed our lives. And we're still fighting with the department on the outcome of that. But you know, it's also important to remember that the department itself is a collective of individuals and a culture, but there are individuals that celebrated that decision and individuals that intentionally obstructed what we were trying to get done. And Lieutenant Greg Thompson and Paul Tanaka are absolutely the main variables in what ultimately happened to me.
Yeah.
The FBI came to me and said, "We are in fear for your life." And Robert Federici wrote an article on this. They used, you know, and I'm not here to point fingers at the FBI. Again, I accept what happened in this. But the FBI came to me first and said, "We are concerned about your safety. You have death threats." And they're credible death threats. And I still live with those death threats. I mean, I reported a white supremacist gang and an LA County deputy sheriff, and here I am again sitting in front of you. It is not easy to do this. Most people would not do this.
Now, so I want to talk a little bit more about that, because this is obviously something that has hugely impacted your life. You've said that you have a lot of respect for the LA County Sheriff's Department still. So I think, can you help our audience understand? You're saying that you've received credible death threats from your colleagues, from people who served alongside you.
And were physically, you have been assaulted by your colleagues.
Yes, I have. And this is, my vocabulary is a little better than to call them colleagues, okay? Mm-hmm. You're talking about an organization that's made up of tens of thousands of people. I mean, when you get into the civilian side of it and whatnot, I have brothers that I serve with and I still communicate with and sisters. And you just will not find a better group of individuals that are dedicated to the ideas and principles of law enforcement.
People who supported you all the way through
absolutely.
This.
They were, and you were at the trial, and they were there, you know, when others weren't. And then you have the folks that you know make law enforcement a bad profession, and you know that's everywhere. Okay, mm-hmm. And it's not just with the Los Angeles County Sheriff's Department. It's law enforcement in general. You have. I don't know the finite number, but you know, I think there are roughly a million people in law enforcement in some capacity, counting the federal government, and statistically you're going to have some bad actors. I'm lumped into that. I'll be the first, you know, I have two felonies. I can't look people in the eye and say, I'm not one of them. I was convicted for it. It pains me when I got convicted, you know, I wrote three things down and I said, I'm a felon. You have to internalize that. That's a heavy burden. You know, and I know that's a topic for,
especially having been a law enforcement. Yeah.
You know, and at that time I didn't even really understand, you know, how it affects my life today. I said, I'll never be a cop again. I wrote that down. And then I said, I will survive. And I actually wrote that on every cell I left from there on out. I will survive. I will survive. And, but to your point, you know, about respect and all that. The LA County Sheriff's Department was here before I was born. Law enforcement was here before we were all born. It will be here after in some form or capacity. And the principles and the ideas and the philosophy of why it exists is what I have respect for. The things that they're talking about in the pamphlet where, you know, we are the, you know, you see symbolisms of sheepdogs and those types of things, and to be the guardian, and, you know, you have to have that mindset, but it's a tight wire. It's a fine line, and some people don't survive it.
I have a couple of questions. I'm a little curious about how some of these department gangs work. You're in a very unique position of having observed them both as a deputy and as an inmate.
Yes.
We've heard of deputy gangs abusing inmates, but also working with inmates who are sometimes members of inmate gangs,
yes,
smuggling stuff to them, maybe enforcing on their behalf.
Yes.
Which do you think is more prevalent, or are they sort of just operating it concurrently?
Well, it's like anything. There's a your mentality is you can be in a deputy clique and still be a social member. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you're
but
doesn't mean that you're doing nefarious things or even illegal acts over and over and over again. Joe Britton, I made a founded accusation about him receiving tattoos from a white supremacist gang for intimidating a witness on behalf of a double homicide suspect. A credible, reliable informant has him on a wire, has observations of a transaction. In any other scenario, that's enough for a criminal charge, much less a termination. But because the department was undermining my efforts, especially Baca, because of my cooperation with the FBI, they cleaned him up. But here we are again in 2018.
And he's at that station.
He's at that station.
He's working in Compton.
There's issues. Now, he's IOD right now, which is injured on duty. But during the time period of the reason I'm on the show, you know, he was active. And
so let's talk really quickly about reputation within the department, right? We've mentioned, you said that for the experience for most sheriff's deputies is that you are aware of the existence of these groups. You may or may not get asked to join them. A lot of people say no, that's just the end of the story, and they just go on, you know, doing their duty. I want to talk a little bit more about the people that do agree.
Yeah.
Do agree to join up. It doesn't sound like that impacts your career trajectory negatively if you do.
It can, especially so, you know, Region 2, they were familiar with this in the Jail Violence Commission, you know, the ghetto stations, if you will, you know, that has a big draw to the mentality of this. Whether or not it affects your career or not, it's tough to say in this day and age, but when I was in the department, it definitely could affect your career.
Negatively
or positively. Paul Tanaka actually had a very smart framework and methodology about it. He was cultivating the mentality. And again, Baca is not, it's proven now. Baca used to could make claims that he didn't know about it, but Leroy Baca knew about this at all times. And I can, that's not hearsay. I've heard him talk about it. They would cultivate deputies, you know, the recruitment starts in the jails and then works its way out into the stations that are, you know, the stations that are now central, but were Region 2. And then from there you go into the specialized units, and look, this kind of behavior is, sadly, it was glorified in Den of Thieves, you know, just a movie that came out just this year, you know? And that gentleman that movie is made after is still involved in the department deeply, has made threats in the last 18 months because he was friends with Greg Thompson, made threats to Michael Rathbun, who, you know, was my partner in this. And, you know, that's one of those brothers that I can't talk about enough. There are, and again, we're going to make a full circle back to why this is in vogue. There are chiefs that are still in the LA County Sheriff's Department that were in my chain of command during Pandora's Box that received orders from Lee Baca, Tanaka, and we executed, and they're still in the department.
Right.
And they're still in a gang. So,
and presumably retaliated to you once.
Well, not just that, but then this is where I'm saying that the sheriff is disserved. Okay, he needs another term to figure out who those guys are. And, you know, when
you think he should ask you?
I don't.
Would you talk to him about it?
I would love to talk to him about it. I would love to talk about career survival. I would, you know, you need to be ahead of this at the academy level and the jail level, because I said it in my allocution. I mean, by the time, you know, it's easier to fix bent boys than broken men. And by the time you're out on patrol, you are who you're going to be as a cop.
Mm-hmm.
That's where we have to be, you know. Lee Baca authorized the bad backgrounds and the it's not popular to attack Lee Baca even today, you know. Oh, he's like
within the department, you mean?
No, within the community. Hmm. The department, you serve the rank, not the man. All right, it's Sheriff McDonald. It's his office. It's the office of sheriff. It's not Lee Baca's office anymore, but it's still Lee Baca's problem. That man created at least 3 or 4 generations worth of problems, top to bottom. Lee Baca would not correct executives, period, end of story. He was elected in the late 90s. I mean, there was a solid period where nobody under the rank of captain, even at the lieutenant level, was disciplined. And that's where you get into the Bernice Abrams issues. Those are all Tanaka and Baca people.
We talked about with Maya Lau, there was a lot of rhetoric at the time under Baca about like laying the law down about these cliques, about getting rid of some of these gangs. That's all talk.
That's lip service. And yeah. Then, you know, but Tanaka let it keep going. So mm-hmm. Baca knew about it.
Mm-hmm.
And the writing was on the wall for him. And he even had opportunities that if he was the progressive sheriff that he claimed to be, he had plenty of opportunities to stop it. you know, but you can't stop a moving train with your hand. Mm-hmm. You know, he let it get out of control.
Mm-hmm. Well, Sheriff McDonald now has been fairly quiet. We talked about with Maya, he's coming up on a surprisingly contested election. He hasn't made a big issue out of these elements in the sheriff's department. You think he should be publicly making a bigger deal out of it, or?
I think that the strategy that the sheriff's department has presented to him is, if you acknowledge it, it is an admittance that it is admitting that we never fixed it.
Mm-hmm.
And I would say to him, you know, you came in on a honeymoon period where it was popular to, you know, say, hey, I got. I think at the end of the day, there were about 30 deputies that were indicted and convicted, and. You know, I haven't forgotten my friends at the FBI, who I respect too. I think what they were after was fantastic. And I was a willing participant, and that's what sent me to prison, was that I talked 38 times consensually and gave them everything they needed. And look, that's how it happens. But, you know, this was a protracted effort to remove corruption out of the LA County Sheriff's Department. Everybody just got fatigued, FBI included. Brandon Fox, Liz Rhodes, you know. Where, at what point did it stop? They went deputy, sergeant, lieutenant, captain, and then they jumped to under sheriff and sheriff. It's easy to fire the guys at the bottom, brother. Nobody cares about us. Mm-hmm. They don't. Okay. You know, mm-hmm. It's deputy sheriff. But once you get above that rank of captain, which is the problem, which is why we're here today.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, you can tell us in your own words what you think next steps look like, but it sounds like what you're saying is clean house, essentially.
At the top, okay? Yep. I mean, you can broom a deputy and a sergeant out any day of the week. That is easy. That is easy. But it's hard for the guys at the top to hold themselves accountable. It always has been. It always will be. There are guys that are still in the department that were my direct supervisors at the time of Pandora's Box that pretend like it never happened.
Thank you, James Sexton. I mean, it's unbelievable stuff.
Yeah, it's an incredible story. And given the context of the discussion we're having now about the sheriff's department, an extremely relevant one.
Yeah, as he said, it's coming back up.
Yep.
He wanted to clarify something. He texted me after. He said he wants to make clear that he doesn't want people to think that he doesn't have a relationship with his dad. He says that they are on the mend. Things are getting better with him and his dad, which is a good thing. Thanks to both James and Maya for talking to us. Thank you for listening. We'll be back on Monday with another LA podcast. Get you a Baghdadi, Libaka, on trial, trying to portray a boxer. Beating up on my niggas while the CEOs watch them. Tables turn, lesson learned, my best look. You jump sides on me, now you about to meet Westbrook. Go celebrate with your team.